Good day, and welcome to today's iPro Home Health Clinical Strategies to Improve Patient Outcomes conference call. This call is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the call over to Ms. Butterfield. Please go ahead, Ms. Butterfield.
Thank you, and good morning, everyone. We appreciate your patience while we were trying to get the remaining of the callers in and into the conference call to participate. Thanks for joining us this morning. This is part of a series of our educational offerings addressing clinical strategies to improve patient outcomes in the home health provider setting. And today's presentation is going to be focused on the evaluation of patient medications and possible interactions and side effects that predispose patients to fall-related injuries at home. Those of you who registered for today's call were forwarded via email a copy of both of the presentation slides and a program evaluation form. If for some reason you did not register or did not receive a copy of the slides and evaluation, you can visit the iPro website, providers.ipro.org/index/home health, and go down to the upcoming events section, and you'll see a link for today's presentation with the slides posted there for you. As a reminder, the conference call is being taped, and we're going to be posting it to the same home health section of the website under the past events section to make it available for future review and for any of your staff that you may want to have listen to the call after the presentation. It will be posted there in about 4 to 5 business days. And as we mentioned, all of the lines currently are muted, but following presentation, we're going to be opening the lines up for your questions and comments and further discussion. Now, those of you that are part of the clinical identified participant group agencies that are working with iPro, we invite you to remain on the line following Dr. Triller's presentation and the question and answer period. From about 10 to 10:30 time frame, we're going to talk about some status updates, and we'll open the line up for some open forum discussion of any issues you'd like to talk about related to the initiatives that you're working on with us. So again, the clinical identified participant group agencies, we invite you to stay on the call following the presentation. We're very pleased to have with us this morning our guest speaker, Dr. Darren Triller. Dr. Triller received his bachelor's degree in pharmacy from the Albany College of Pharmacy in 1989 and received his doctor of pharmacy degree from the Albany College of Pharmacy in 1988, graduating magna cum laude. Since completing a 2-year fellowship in home health care, he served as a tenure track assistant professor at the Albany College of Pharmacy and in the Department of Pharmacy Practice. He recently joined iPro about a year ago in the Healthcare Quality Improvement Program team and has been contributing to the efforts relating to improvements in the Medicare drug benefit as well as home care initiatives. His clinical work and research focused on the identification and resolution of drug-related problems in the community-dwelling elderly and in the development and evaluation of novel care delivery models such as home-based pharmacist visits, automated drug dispensing systems, and telehome care services. He has published a significant number of peer-reviewed manuscripts relating to adverse drug events, drug-related problems, and the medication use system. He has also served as either the principal investigator or as a significant contributor to the number of studies competitively funded by private foundations and government agencies, and also has many publications related to pharmacotherapy. And we're very excited to have Dr. Triller here at iPro because he serves as a very excellent resource for our home health project team. And many of you probably participated on a conference call about 3 or 4 months ago where he presented with regards to medication management. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Triller.
Well, good morning, everybody, and thank you, Sarah, for the opportunity to talk to all of the home care agencies. As you mentioned, I do have a number of years in home care under my belt, so the topic is very near and dear to me. And so today we're going to talk about falls and avoidance of injuries due to falls with a focus mostly on medications. So as far as learning objectives, on our learning objective slide, I'm going to spend a little bit of time reviewing the many biological processes that are involved in being able to stand and to ambulate without hurting yourself. And then we're going to discuss the impact medications can have on each of those systems. And hopefully at the end I'll give you some information that will guide you to resources that you can take with you and apply at your own individual agencies to improve the medication therapy of your individual patients. So going on to the next slide, this is an interactive teleconference. I thought we'd take a moment just to highlight how many different things are involved in standing an ambulation. I thought it'd be nice to take a moment and find a partner if you have other people in the room, identify that person, and just take a moment and stand up and watch how one another comes to standing. And I can assure you that the four people from the iPro Home team are going to be doing this at the same time. So just keep an eye on the person and go ahead and stand up while you're watching the people and act. Watch how they do it. Watch how they do it. So our team is now standing. Take a look at whether they're using their arms to come to standing, to whether they had to move chairs out of the way, the types of things that we might take for granted when it comes to ambulation. Now, I don't want you to do this because we tried this before, and the idea of raising to a standing position on only 1 foot from a chair. So I don't want to have any injuries out there. But again, it's just an idea to highlight how involved and how many things come into play in something as mundane and routine as coming to a vertical position. So you can all sit down, catch your breath, and relax, and we're going to move on to the next slide. So as I was contemplating how to go about this presentation, I started scribbling out all of the different systems that are actually involved in what you just accomplished. The first one being a suitable environment. You may have had to move something out of the way, and you know going into your home care visits that you always assess patients' homes for cords and carpets and clutter and things like that. But you also have a huge number of physiologic things going on that make it possible to stand. The first, probably the most important one, is control over your voluntary nervous system. You have to be able to send the signal from your brain to your musculature to actually be able to move your legs and your hands and the rest of your body into the position and to actually carry out the act of coming to a standing position. You need the muscle strength to do it. And trying to stand up on 1 foot is a far cry from standing up with both feet, and it really shows how much strength you need to raise a 150 or 200-pound person to a standing position. Visual acuity comes into play as you gauge where you're standing and your relationship to other objects that are around you. And so vision is very important. One thing that might be overlooked is vasoconstriction. If you think about your blood pressure and in a sitting position or in a laying position, when you come to standing, you've now raised your head several feet above the rest of your body. And to maintain perfusion to your brain, you actually need to accommodate very quickly within those couple seconds to increase the pressure in your legs and your abdomen to maintain the pressure in your head. I had an event a couple months ago where I was taking a medication for my back, and I stood up in the middle of the night and started seeing spots, room starts spinning, everything. I went from an inclined position to standing very, very quickly. And one of the key physiologic processes that's going on that maintains that pressure is vasoconstriction. And we're going to talk about the drugs later that affect that. So you really do very quickly need to accommodate and have the blood vessels in your legs and your abdomen constrict to maintain the pressure to your head, or you're going to get syncopal and perhaps fall. Plasma volume is also necessary to maintain blood pressure. There's a few different things that your body does to maintain blood pressure. Vasoconstriction is one. And having enough volume to constrict is another main one. If you are dehydrated due to hemorrhaging, due to diuretics, which we'll talk about, due to any purpose, poor fluid intake, just your patients that don't have adequate fluid intake, if you're dehydrated, even if you can vasoconstrict those vessels, there's not enough volume in the pump to raise the pressure. And again, it's going to contribute to hypotension and perhaps the falls. Why do you need that pressure to your head? Well, because you need to deliver oxygen to your brain. Think about it. Your patients with COPD, lung disease, if you don't have adequate oxygen carrying capacity, it doesn't matter if you've got blood to your head if there's no oxygen there. So people who are anemic, again, who have been hemorrhaging, people had recent surgeries, have low iron capacity, those folks, again, are going to be at increased risk of falls because they don't have enough oxygen-carrying capacity to the brain. Blood glucose might be overlooked in falls. You don't hear a lot of people talking about blood glucose and falls, But again, you need the energy in your brain to have it function properly, and the only source of energy that your brain can use is glucose. Your muscles can use fat, they can use carbohydrates, they can break down proteins, but your brain can only use glucose. So adequate blood glucose is actually necessary to ambulate and to get up and around and to have your brain keep functioning as you come to a stand. And then finally, as you come to that stand, after vasoconstriction and the fluid volume are constricted to raise that blood pressure, your heart rate should also pick up. And the contractility of your heart, to increase that stroke volume for every beat of your heart, should also go up to maintain that blood pressure. So all sorts of things are involved in something as simple as standing up. So now what we're going to do is we're going to think about how medications might affect these various physiologic systems. The next slide, though, before we go on to the drugs, is why do we care if people fall? And I was kidding around with Sarah the other day about the Bumbles, the abominable snowman in the old Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, how he fell off the cliff and came back later, and it's because Bumbles bounce was what, who was the person there? Not Yosemite Sam, but whatever. The Bumble fell, but didn't get hurt because it bounced right back. We wish our patients could bounce right back because the problem with falls is not the fall. The problem is the injury incurred when you fall. So what sorts of things are needed to avoid being injured when you fall? And one of the main things in our elderly is bone strength. We're worried about wrist fractures, rib fractures, and most importantly, hip fractures when they fall. So bone density is very, very important. And then also, along the same lines of injury, is an intact coagulation cascade. If a patient falls and hits their head on the edge of a sink, or as a skin tear, a laceration, you need to be able to clot. You don't want to have a hemorrhage. And so an intact coagulation cascade is very, very important. And then, again, the safe environment, where did they fall, what did they hit, is going to have a lot to do with how severely injured they are. And then the response, if a patient does fall and is injured, the severity of that injury may be affected by how quickly they can get emergency support. So if they have a family member, are they able to call for help? Do they have EMTs in the area? All of those things are going to contribute to the severity of the fall. If they can't get very quick response after they've been injured, then the likelihood of them being hurt more seriously is increased. So those are the things, the physiologic systems that are going to help you stand and ambulate, and the types of characteristics that are going to affect how severely injured you may be if you fall. So let's start talking about medications. So we'll move on to the next slide. Are medications part of the solution, or are they part of the problem? And as we all know, we're relying more and more on medications to treat illnesses, whether to treat acute illnesses or to prevent the occurrence of other diseases. The number of medications that your home care patients especially are taking has gone up dramatically. I remember seeing literature from the early 70s where the average patient is on about 4 meds or so. A few years ago, working with the home care agencies, that number was 9, and I've seen patients on as many as 42. Chronically administered medications, and you've seen them all. You go into the houses, you see the boxes, you see the bottle. Are they helping? Are they hurting? We know they keep people alive longer. We know they keep people out of pain and help them function and things, but at some point, the drug regimens can become part of the problem. The advent of the Medicare Part D program just over a year ago is helpful because it increases access to medications for many of our seniors, but having more medications around, again, can perhaps be contributing to the problem. As you are taking more and more medications, the likelihood of having a drug interaction or an adverse drug event goes up dramatically. It's not linear. It's a logarithmic increase in risk as the number of drugs go up. So going from one drug to 2, and then 2 drugs to 4, and then 4 drugs to 6, the risk goes up more than in a linear fashion. It's actually an exponential rise in risk as your number of drugs goes up. And just the sheer volume of refills and bottles and things to manipulate makes managing those drugs very, very difficult. So we need the medications to keep alive and to be able to function and to prevent other illnesses from affecting our lives, but we also can't avoid the fact that these medications are getting very, very hard to manage and might be contributing to adverse events in our folks. So on to the next slide about what do drugs affect, and this is the same slide as before with all those physiologic systems that are required just to stand up. And many people always ask, you know, what drugs increase the risk of falls? And we're going to maybe take a different approach. I'm not going to give you the list up front. We're going to look over each of these physiologic systems and talk about how drugs might affect them. And if you're looking at the PowerPoint version of the slides electronically, you'll see that the only one that I have crossed out as the drugs not affecting is the suitable environment, that the drugs can actually affect every other aspect of your body functions that are necessary for rising and for ambulating. So let's go through these one by one. Your voluntary nervous system. As you know, many drugs can impair your ability to control voluntary movements. Alcohol is a great example. You know that at a certain amount of alcohol, you start to lose the ability to control your motions. And it's dose-related, and that's a key point for many of these the drugs and the systems we're talking about. There is a dose-response relationship. So you may not be able to get your patients off of all these drugs, but we definitely want to keep our elderly folks on the minimum effective dose of all those drugs. You know that one dose of alcohol may not impair your ability to ambulate, whereas 6 or 8 or 10 absolutely do. Finding the dose of a therapeutic agent that is effective without incapacitating the patient is a real trick. So we always go low, go slow with doses, and occasionally try and back off on certain doses of medications to just make sure that you're using what's absolutely minimum necessary in your seniors. So alcohol is an obvious one. Other drugs such as benzodiazepines, such as Xanax or Ativan, lorazepam, those drugs can impair the ability to ambulate, and they've been shown to increase the risk of falls. Again, it's a dose-response relationship. So we're not saying your patients shouldn't be on these, but by reducing the dose in your seniors, you reduce the risk of having a fall due to these drugs. Sleep aids. Many drugs, Sonata and Ambien, and a lot of the drugs being marketed directly to the public can increase the risk of falls. Some of these drugs have very rapid onset, and I would actually advise our patients to take them when they're ready for bed, sitting in bed, so that they're not up and around the house, going to the bathroom. Don't take the drug when you're watching the news and then planning on going up the stairs. So be very careful when your patients are using sleep aids and make sure that they're using the lowest dose possible and that they're using them appropriately, that they're not getting up in the middle of the night and wandering the house or taking a dose an hour before they plan on going upstairs. People ask which drug is the best. I tend to recommend Ambien for the folks who absolutely need a sleep aid, not because it's a better sleep drug, but because it comes in tablets. The regular immediate release Ambien, you can break the tablets in half. So you can tell a senior, if you get a prescription and the standard dose is 10 milligrams that a physician may prescribe to the average person, ask for 5 and break them in half and get away with the lowest dose you can. You can't break the sustained release ones and do those sorts of things. Other drugs such as antipsychotics, narcotics obviously, and a growing number of drugs that are out there for neuropathic pain, so things like Neurontin or Gabapentin that you're treating your diabetic neuropathy folks with can be very sedating, especially when they first start taking those drugs, and they can impair their ability to ambulate. So there's a variety of drugs, and your patients may be on many of these drugs that are on this list already at one time, which again increases your risk. So drugs can very clearly affect the voluntary nervous system, and the key point is that type of impairment is typically dose-related, so you want to only use the drugs if absolutely necessary, and you want to make sure the patients are using the lowest dose possible, and that you titrate them up very slowly so that you can avoid quick onset of adverse reactions, and then titrate very slowly to whatever's an effective dose. Going on to muscle strength, the next slide. There's not too many drugs that directly affect muscle strength that your typical patient would be on, but many drugs can contribute to neuropathies, myopathies, and myalgias. Drugs that come to mind that a lot of your home care folks are going to be on: chronic corticosteroids, so your people who are on prednisone orally long-term can actually get proximal wasting of the large muscles in your limbs. So your leg muscles and your arm muscles start to atrophy, and then you get that central obesity. So the folks who are on high-dose prednisone have the little stick legs and the little stick arms and the big round bellies. Well, they get that proximal muscle wasting, and that can increase the risk of fall. So steroids need to be monitored very closely, and those folks need very close attention. cholesterol-lowering agents can cause myalgias, and patients who are taking any of the statins or cholesterol drugs should report to the physician immediately if they have any muscle pain. Drugs for HIV can contribute to muscle wasting. Chemotherapeutic agents can cause neuropathies and things that may impair the ability to ambulate. And so can some vitamin deficiencies. Vitamin B12 comes to mind. A lot of seniors can develop a pernicious anemia from vitamin B12 deficiency. And not only are they anemic, so their blood counts are altered, but they actually can get these peripheral neuropathies that alter their gait, offer their sensation in their legs and their feet. And a simple B12 injection or the nasal B12 supplement could actually address that. Moving on, visual acuity. Many drugs can affect patient vision, either acutely or chronically over time. Our project they're working on with iPro focuses on anticholinergic drugs, older antihistamines and things like that, that can affect how your eye accommodates to changes in light. They tend to dilate your pupils. So elderly folks who are taking these drugs, if it's a nighttime situation and they turn on a light to go to the bathroom and things like that, their eyes cannot adjust to the light, and they could perhaps be put at risk of falls. It's a problem with driving. When they can't accommodate from bright light drives past them in another oncoming car, their eyes can't accommodate, and it may affect their vision in that way. And they're very commonly used. Antipsychotic drugs, especially the older phenothiazine drugs, over time can cause retinal deposits. Many of your folks are on digoxin. You know, we monitor the serum levels very closely. One of the key symptoms of digoxin toxicity is a yellow halo. They start seeing visual changes. The Van Gogh picture of Starry, Starry Night, that kind of look of the halos, and they think that possibly he may have had digitalis toxicity when he painted those, but it's that hue, those halos around things, and you can see how that would affect your vision. So if you have a patient reporting those sort of yellow halos around things, it might be a sign of digoxin toxicity. Time to get their levels done. Anti-rheumatic drugs such as Imuran or hydroxychloroquine are commonly used for rheumatoid arthritis and psoriasis and other disorders and can cause visual changes, and so those folks need annual eye exams to make sure that the drug's not causing toxicity. Corticosteroids and drugs for gout like allopurinol can cause cataracts that are going to affect their vision over the long term, and even the erectile dysfunction drugs such as Viagra can cause visual changes. They alters color vision, so reds and greens and blues may be garbled, and they may not be able to distinguish between different colors. And actually, I believe in the package insert for the drug, there's recommendations that pilots should not fly within a certain number of hours of using the drug because they might not be able to distinguish between reds and greens and things. So you got to be careful when you're using those drugs. So your elderly folks need annual eye exams, and preferably dilated eye exams. So for diabetes and everything, you need to have this visual acuity checked because there's so many different things in addition to natural aging that can affect their visual acuity. Moving on to vasoconstriction. And if we had to focus on any of them, this is probably the one that I'd be most concerned about because it can have. There are so many drugs that can contribute to vasodilation, and I believe it is such a strong factor in contributing to falls. Many of your cardiovascular drugs for hypertension, for heart failure, can contribute to this peripheral vasodilation so that when you go to try and stand, there's a delay in the amount or a delay in the time in which your blood vessels can constrict and push the blood to your head. So when you stood up earlier in the program, your blood vessels should constrict very quickly. If they don't constrict quickly enough, you're going to get orthostatic hypotension, and you could pass out and have a fall. Now, reviewing the types of drugs that can contribute to this, beta blockers, such as Toprol XL for hypertension and heart failure, many of your folks are on that. It's also available in eye drops, and there have been reports of folks with glaucoma getting orthostatic hypotension from their eye drops because a certain amount of the drug is actually absorbed through your nasal passages after you administer eye drops and from the mucosa around your eyes and can actually contribute to orthostatic hypotension. Alpha blockers can be used for hypertension, so drugs like Cardura are often used, but the drugs they use for benign prostate disease are also alpha blockers and can contribute to orthostasis. They actually recommend these drugs be, when a patient takes a first dose, to take it sitting down and monitor them very closely, because some patients, as soon as their first dose, will become orthostatic, syncopal, and fall. Calcium channel blockers are commonly used for heart disease. So Norvasc, amlodipine, is the number one drug used to treat hypotension. It dilates those peripheral blood vessels. Pure vasodilators like your nitrates and hydralazine are also going to dilate those blood vessels. So your nitroDIR patches and your oral capsules and things that you're taking, your IMDIRs and things like that, those are nitrates that can lower blood pressure, as well as your sublinguals. So if you've got patients who are using sublingual nitroglycerin for angina, you want them to sit when they're taking them, to not rise quickly and things. It can actually induce a fall. So all of those cardiovascular drugs, and many of your patients are on 4, 5, or 6 of them, can contribute to vasodilation. And so when your patients stand up, they cannot maintain the pressures to their head, and it puts them at risk. In addition to the cardiovascular drugs, many of the older antipsychotics, the old tricyclic antidepressants, some of these, what I refer to as sloppy old drugs, contribute to falls, not because they're causing the impact that we said earlier on the cognitive function and on the voluntary muscle activity. They are actually also alpha blockers and can cause vasodilation, just like the cardiovascular drugs can. So your patient who's taking 25 milligrams of amitriptyline at night to help them sleep, it might be impairing their cognition, and it's also acting as an anticholinergic, and it's also acting as a vasodilator. So the trade-off is we want to sleep, but we're putting your patient at risk in a number of different ways. What I would strongly recommend for your agency is a simple, quick fix, not a fix, but a simple system change to identify these patients, is to make doing orthostatic blood pressure monitoring standard for all your patients. Have them sitting down, get a nice seated blood pressure, go through your OASIS 16-page, you know, admission questionnaire, and then have them stand up and take their blood pressure standing. If they have more than a 20-point systolic drop in blood pressure or more than a 10-point drop in diastolic blood pressure, they've got orthostasis. Or if they just experience symptoms, that's going to tell you this patient is at risk of getting syncopal and having a fall. So do it on admission. And then perhaps if you can do it on all your visits and train your staff what to look for and what to report. Because this is the type of thing that can change very quickly. It can change when they start a new drug. It can change if they start using the diuretic. It can change if they started using a PRN dose of a diuretic. So you need to do it on a regular basis and to train your patients to identify those symptoms. Have them sit up slowly, swing their legs over, all those things. But measuring and documenting those orthostatic blood pressures, I think, would be a fantastic no-cost idea for identifying these patients so that you can provide better care to them. Moving on to plasma volume. Again, this also contributes to that orthostasis. Removing plasma volume reduces the ability of your body to maintain that blood pressure in your head when you stand up. So how many of your folks are on loop diuretics, at Lasix, due to heart failure or just regular problems with edema? Your thiazide diuretics like hydrochlorothiazide, how many are drinking caffeine? How many are not drinking enough during the day? So if you deplete that volume, you're putting them at risk. So you should be assessing your patients for plasma volume. Ask about dry mouth. Pinch the backs of their hands to see if their skin snaps back. Again, do the orthostatic blood pressures, but monitor their hydration status very, very closely. Things that can indirectly affect the plasma volume, as far as drugs are concerned, drugs that induce vomiting or diarrhea can deplete the plasma volume. If a patient's diabetes are not well controlled, they get polyuria and can get dehydrated. And then also, if your patients are just over-sedated by the psychoactive drugs, they may not be getting up to drink, they may not feel motivated to ingest liquids and food, and you're putting them at risk. So plasma volume, many, many patients out there are dehydrated and really need to be encouraged to drink. Elderly folks lose a bit of their natural stimulus to drive thirst, so they don't feel thirsty the way you do very quickly. You talk for an hour in a teleconference, and you're parched, and you run out and get a bottle of water. The elderly don't have that same sensation. And if they're on a drug that gives them a dry mouth all the time, they don't really feel it. So you need to make sure they continue to be hydrated to reduce the risk of falls. Moving on to oxygen carrying capacity, again, if the folks can't get the oxygen where it needs to go, they're again at risk of getting orthostatic and perhaps falling. Many drugs can contribute to anemia in folks. Your chemotherapy patients, obviously, are getting their blood counts decimated. Drugs for HIV and sometimes even antibiotics can affect red cell counts and patients' oxygen carrying capacity. Some drugs can contribute directly to either pulmonary toxicity or just pulmonary symptoms. Long-term use of amiodarone, chemotherapy drugs like methotrexate can actually cause actual pulmonary toxicity. So chest x-rays, things like that, reporting symptoms of pulmonary disease in folks who are using those drugs is very important. A small segment of the population is very sensitive to NSAIDs and aspirin and can actually get bronchial constriction and asthmatic type attacks by using aspirin and NSAIDs. So you need to be very careful about how those drugs are used. And the beta blockers that we use for hypertension and for heart disease can also cause bronchoconstriction in some folks, which again, if you've got a COPD person who's bad enough already, putting them on a high dose beta blocker can actually make their breathing worse. So drugs can contribute again to poor oxygen delivery. Moving on, blood glucose. Patients, there are many, many new drugs out now for diabetes, and many of them can contribute to hypoglycemia. So obviously insulin can, and so you need to counsel your patients on appropriate diet and adjustment of their insulin doses. Your sulfonylureas and your metiglinides, meglitinides like prandin, are drugs that can cause very quick onset hypoglycemia. So you should advise your patients, if they're taking these drugs, to only take them if they know they're going to be eating. Because if they miss a meal, their sugars are going to bottom out. And the newer drugs like Byetta and Simlin, which many patients are on, can also contribute to hypoglycemia. What I'd strongly recommend you do is you go in and train your nurses to look over the blood glucose sheets of when the patients are documenting their sugars. And if you're seeing the occasional number in the 50s and the 60s and things, to report it to the physician. Because a low sugar in many of these folks is more dangerous than a high sugar. A low sugar can make them pass out, fall, and break a hip. A sugar of 212 is going to increase the risk over the next 5 years of having visual changes, kidney damage, and some micro or macrovascular disease. In the short term, a low sugar is a very, very dangerous thing, and we need to pay very, very close attention to it. One other time to be very wary of hypoglycemia is when you're tapering patients off courses of corticosteroids. So your patient who has a COPD exacerbation, and they throw them on a week of prednisone. Prednisone is a glucocorticoid. It increases blood sugars. And I've seen patients who have gone into the hospital with COPD who were then diagnosed during that hospitalization as being diabetic. And they put the person on drugs for diabetes. They sent them home, withdrew all of the prednisone over several days without adjusting those diabetic drugs, and the person's sugars came down as they took away the corticosteroids. This person was lying on the couch, could barely get up, and had sugars in the 40s. It was the taking away of a corticosteroid that induced the hypoglycemia. So whenever you've got a person who is diabetic or is on short bursts of steroids, you have to watch them very, very closely. Also, if you abruptly stop corticosteroids after you've been on them a long time, your body has lost the ability to manufacture its own cortisol, and you can get hypotension and dehydration and low potassium and all those things. So watch your corticosteroid, folks. The people who are using the oral prednisone, watch them like a hawk. Going on to cardiac reserve, again, when you stand up, your heart rate needs to pick up and your heart needs to beat stronger. What are we giving everybody? We're giving them beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, digoxin, drugs that slow the heart rate and reduce contractility. When you think about all the medications you're on, when you've got heart failure, you're taking away their vasoconstriction, you're taking away their volume, and you're taking away their ability to raise their heart rate. You're basically kicking out the crutches for all these different physiologic systems that are really needed to ambulate quickly and to adjust those blood pressures. So you need to watch them very closely. So that's kind of a whirlwind tour, but we just went through every single aspect of what it takes to actually just come to a stand and stay conscious. And yet we've got drugs that almost every one of your patients seems to be on. Everything from voluntary nervous system to muscle strength to the cardiovascular system to volume to oxygen to everything, your drugs can potentially affect every aspect of that. And if you're on multiple drugs, plus you're frail, plus you may have Parkinson's disease or other disorders, you can see how, as patients age and become more frail, how these drugs can be contributing to falls. And you can't point your finger just at one drug and say, oh, that's a bad drug, it increases risk of falls, because you could be on 9 or 10 different drugs that could be affecting all these different systems. Moving on, how might drugs affect the degree of injury? Again, bone density, coagulation cascade are very important in reducing the ability, the likelihood of being hurt when you fall. So moving on, what drugs can affect that? Fractures are increased due to osteoporosis. Again, your chronic corticosteroids, your folks who are on prednisone long-term, are at increased risk of osteoporosis. These folks should be getting calcium and perhaps be treated with one of the available drugs to either prevent or treat osteoporosis. Chronic or frequent heparin injections. I remember the home care agency I worked with had a patient who was on lifelong heparin due to coagulopathy, and they used to refer to him as the rubber band man because he had lost most of his bone mass. They do x-rays and bone scans, and this poor gentleman, due to the heparin, had very severe osteoporosis. So chronic corticosteroids. And what drugs can increase the risk of hemorrhaging? Anticoagulants like warfarin and heparin, and again, the antiplatelet drugs. And I would throw in there also the NSAIDs, the ibuprofens and the naprosyns, which your folks may be using. And you're now seeing folks coming out after getting stents placed and carotid endarterectomies and things where they're getting Coumadin and antiplatelet drugs. And they might also be taking a pain medication over the counter. They're at very high risk of experiencing a bleed if they fall. And it can be a severe bleed. It could be life-threatening. And how can drugs affect the patient's ability to call for help or respond to a fall if their cognition is impaired, if they have delirium or dementia? Due to the many drugs they're on, they may not be able to function to dial the phone, they may not be able to call out, or they may lose consciousness where another person may not. So the drugs not only can increase your risk of falling, but increase the risk of harm when you do fall. So, in summary, ambulation is a very incredibly complex activity. It involves many, many different systems, and the drugs can affect practically every single one of them in one way or another, either in the short term or across the long term. They can increase the severity of injuries that are sustained and can also delay the access or the request for assistance after they have fallen. How does that affect you home care folks? On to the next slide. You know your typical person came out of a hospital or had some index health event that requires your services. They're at risk just because of that. Many of those folks just had their medications changed. Many of their medications changed, and there's that gap between when they come out of the hospital of when their medical record catches up to their primary care office, and we know all the problems associated with changes in health status. They've got many multiple comorbidities, cardiovascular disease, COPD, diabetes. They use many of those different drugs we talked about. And you know their environments are quite variable as far as clutter, safety, the amount of support they're getting. So what can be done? Moving on to the next slide. I don't want to spend a lot of time on the general things that you are already perfectly aware of. You need to train your staff, make them more aware, make sure that their assessments are more thorough and that they're more likely to identify important changes in patient status and report them. You want to try and direct your resources towards your highest risk patients. You can't be doing everything for everybody, so it makes sense to focus on the highest risk folks. And again, to improve your responsiveness when you do see things that look out of line. Specific to the medications, on the next slide, what can you do? Many of the medications are in fact needed for your patient to stay well, so you can't just say wholesale, get rid of the medications, they're part of the problem. What you can do is try and facilitate a process to get rid of any drugs that aren't absolutely necessary. Ideally, you could do some of this screening right at admission. If we're taking an intake, you know, if you've got a liaison at a hospital and you're doing discharge planning, maybe there's an opportune time to look for medications that are not entirely necessary and to suggest getting them either removed or switched to a more suitable alternative. And ideally, you would do this sort of screening before a fall happens, but sometimes the doctors may not change their medications, but they might change the medications after falls occurred. If you say this patient has fallen and here is a drug we think they don't need, they might be more responsive. So moving on to the next slide, what types of drugs are we talking about? There has been for a couple decades a list of medications referred to as the Beers List, named after Dr. Mark Beers, and it was an expert geriatric panel that identified a number of drugs that are generally inappropriate for people over 65 years old. And the way a drug finds its way onto that list is if the side effect profile is unacceptable in the elderly, if the drugs have not been well proven to actually work, or if there's more suitable alternatives available, if the pharmacokinetics of these drugs changed as patients age. And by that, what I mean is the time that it takes to eliminate a drug can be longer in the elderly than in a younger person. So a simple drug like Tylenol PM has diphenhydramine in it as a sleep aid, and it may work perfectly fine for you, and it may be cleared out of your system in 8 to 12 hours. In an elderly person, the drug may linger for 72 hours. So some of these older drugs, which are fine in younger folks, stick around far too long in the elderly and can increase the risk of falls. In many cases, there's more suitable alternatives available. So if one of the Beers List drugs is amitriptyline, there are better alternatives for depression and for sleep and for all those different things that they use amitriptylines for that are less likely to cause the problems in the elderly. And these drugs are the center point of quality measures by NCQA, HEDIS measures, Department of Health, and even the federal government has adopted this list of drugs as ways of measuring quality, especially in nursing homes and other settings. So it would be appropriate to apply the same list of drugs to avoid to your home care population. Moving on to the next slide, how are you going to do that? You don't have the resources and the time to develop an elaborate intervention. Well, the New York State Department of Health developed a clinical tool, which is the link is there listed on your slide. And what this form does is it identifies the drugs from the Beers List, gives you the generic and their name brands. It gives a brief description of why those drugs are of concern in the elderly, and then makes recommendations as to what might be a suitable response or alternative to those drugs. So a simple intervention might be somehow screening your patients on admission for these drugs and perhaps directing this form to those prescribers, either by fax or by mail in some way, but make use of what the DOH has put out there to help communicate with the prescribers. If you can get rid of the drugs the patients don't need, that limits their list to the drugs that are absolutely necessary. Moving on, there's other resources along the same lines. This is another slide, this one from the American Society of Consultant Pharmacists, and this is a group of pharmacists that do the drug regimen reviews in nursing homes. And on this webpage, part of what they call the Fleetwood Project, they have a toolkit that includes checklists and dear doctor letters, things like that, that are targeting inappropriate drug use primarily in the nursing home setting, but you could use these and adopt these forms and revise them in the home care setting because they're the same patient population. They're the elderly polypharmacy folks. So I would invite you to visit that that web page and to look at that toolkit and perhaps contact them about adopting or revising those tools for use in your own setting. So 90% of the work would be done. It might just be a formatting change to make it more applicable to your own setting. Moving on to my shameless plug for our iPro Date project. This is a project that I'm focusing on, not specific to home care, but to Part D beneficiaries in general. And what we are doing is targeting anticholinergic drugs, many of which are represented in that same Beers List. And there's a lot of medical evidence now that shows these drugs like amitriptyline, like diphenhydramine, these older drugs that are already considered potentially inappropriate in the elderly. There are studies showing that they may worsen the course of Alzheimer's disease, that they can cause measurable cognitive impairment in the elderly and increase risk of falls. So if you move on to the next page, we've developed free CME-accredited programs for prescribers, and they're now available on our webpage. So your prescribers, if you find patients are on these, you could direct them to this CE program that talks about why these drugs are potentially inappropriate and what alternatives are out there. There's also a patient worksheet there that you are welcome to use that basically the intent is to facilitate a dialogue between the patient and the prescriber. It asks them about symptoms that they may be experiencing that might be due to these drugs: dry mouth, constipation, urinary retention, memory impairment, things like that. It asks them to write out what drugs they're taking, and it asks them to bring it in and discuss it with their physician at their next office visit. You are more than welcome to use that as a conduit of conversation between the patient and their prescribers for your home care patients. Also on the back of the page is a small box that tells the physician about the free CME programs and things, trying to increase physician awareness of this problem. We're also in the process of developing a clinical tool a bit like the one from New York State Department of Health that identifies the problems with anticholinergic drugs and gives them guidance as to what drugs would be more suitable alternatives. And again, once that is available, we'd be thrilled if you would make use of that as well. Moving on to the next slide. Apart from getting rid of the drugs that are not needed or that are known to be potentially harmful, what else can you do? Vigilance, monitoring these drugs, especially the ones that we touched on earlier, as part of your routine care plan is very, very important. Anytime you start a new drug or stop a drug, it can cause problems. Starting a new drug can lead to interactions or just side effects of the drug. Sometimes actually removing a drug can cause problems. For example, if one drug increases the clearance of another drug, let's say you've got a patient who's on Coumadin who's getting an antibiotic. When they start the antibiotic, it can affect their INR. It can increase the risk of bleeding. So you need to watch their INR more closely when they start the antibiotic. When they stop the antibiotic, the INR might go back down and your patient could become subtherapeutic. So anytime you start or stop a drug, you really need to watch the patient very, very closely. So you think of stopping a drug as being a good thing. You need to watch the patients in a week or two even after you stop a drug. And again, things like orthostatic hypotension, assessing your patient's gait, assessing their cognition and their vital signs is very, very important. And the staff should be very tuned into what's unacceptable or what is a significant change and when should they be contacting prescribers. It's unacceptable to have a patient with a number of blood sugars documented in the 40s and 50s and not have some documented correspondence with the physician. It would be unacceptable to have a patient with orthostatic symptoms and blood pressures to just document it and not follow up. So we really need to not only assess, but have these thresholds for acting. When you're doing blood work, when you're drawing the blood and sending them off to the lab, ask or demand those results. If the patient's on Dilantin, and that drug can affect their cognition and increase the risk of falls. If they're on Coumadin, and it can increase the risk of bleeds, it'd be very helpful to get that information so you know how best to respond for your patients. And again, report any significant findings that you come across. Moving on to the next slide, in addition to monitoring, reduce the risk of harm when they fall. Bone strength is a very, very important thing. It'd be very simple to screen patients at admission. Are they elderly? Females? Are they getting calcium? And have they been assessed for osteoporosis? And very, very few patients who have even fallen are actually getting treated for osteoporosis or getting their calcium. And I read just yesterday as I was preparing, there's actually new evidence that shows that patients who take calcium supplements are at a lower risk of experiencing a fall, because calcium is a major electrolyte involved in muscle contraction. You not only need calcium for your bone strength, you need it for your muscle strength. So simple things like, I want to make sure that my elderly patients, predominantly the females, are getting calcium and are getting assessed for osteoporosis. You also, again, want to watch your anticoagulant folks, your Coumadin folks, like a hawk. Get those blood results and make sure you're taking special care with those folks. Coumadin is repeatedly on the top of lists of drugs causing elderly people to use ERs, to be hospitalized, or die to an adverse drug event. If you want to focus on a big-ticket item, focus on your Coumadin folks. It'd be a nice quality improvement initiative that could focus almost exclusively on a single drug and save a lot of harm from your patients. Next slide. Although they're not at the point where I'd like to see them be, the Medicare Modernization Act that brought us Medicare Part D actually includes in it provisions for patients receiving what they refer to as medication therapy management services. Every single company, every insurance plan that offers a Part D benefit, by law, has to have a medication therapy management program of some sort. That means your patients should be able to be getting their drug regimen reviews done at some level by their health plans, or there should be resources available. Unfortunately, right now, there's a lot of variability between plans as far as what they offer and how mature those programs are, but every health insurance plan must offer some sort of medication therapy management service. If you've got polypharmacy folks, and you walk in and they're on 50 different things and they're getting Medicare Part D drugs, you should call their plan and say, what is available to us? They may have a service where you can talk to a pharmacist and have them review those meds. They may have a program specific for diabetes or for COPD or something, but ask. They must have a program. Also in that act, pharmacies and other providers can now bill Medicare for providing MTM services, and some of the chain pharmacies are developing clinical programs where they can be reimbursed for sitting down with patients and working through all of their drugs and perhaps doing diabetes management and other disease state management programs. Again, they're not at the point where they need to be, but if you start asking for them and asking what's available, you'll capitalize on what is available now and you'll prompt these chains to develop more services in the future. So I would strongly recommend any patient who's got Medicare Part D, who's got polypharmacy issues, that either your case manager or your social workers or somebody contact the plan and their chain pharmacy or their whatever dispensing pharmacy they use and say, what can you do for us? And you'll hopefully find as you move forward with this that these programs will become more and more available and actually perhaps become more useful and helpful to you. Sarah and I have talked about the idea of putting together a directory of sorts of available MTM services, and we're going to look into that, where possibly we could have a web page breaking it down by plan and by pharmacy of what's available in the state so that you could access their referral process information very easily. But ask. Absolutely ask if they've got a Part D plan, and hopefully you'll get some help there that you wouldn't otherwise be getting. So, it is 10 o'clock, and I ended up right on time and didn't do it on purpose, I guess. But conclusion-wise, medications, again, can contribute to falls in so many different ways. You can't avoid using the drugs, but you can do things to get rid of the ones that aren't necessary. We need to take steps to monitor the high-risk patients much more closely, and hopefully you can make use of these MTM services. And if you can do two different things from this point forward, it'd be doing those orthostatic blood pressures on all your patients and asking the plans and the dispensing pharmacies what they can do for you for MTM. Those would be two things that aren't going to cost you anything but may reap huge rewards. Again, please feel free to access our iPro Date Project webpage plus the Home Care Team Project for any new information, and contact us if there's anything else we can do. And with that, I'd be willing to take any questions from anybody that's out there.
Okay. Operator, could you open the lines up for questions, please?
Thank you. Today's question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question at this time, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, that is star 1 if you do have a question at this time.
While we're waiting for the first question, when you're talking about the medication management, therapy management mm-hmm. services, I know that they vary by plans. Do they then, if the home health agency contacts them and consults with them, do they then call the physician? Will the pharmacy medical therapy management plan follow up with the physician?
It depends on the plan. All these programs, CMS, when the legislation was written, it said you must offer MTM services, but gave very few details as to what those services will be. So one plan might have a diabetes project mm-hmm. where they're just screening patients with diabetic drugs and they are contacting the physicians, perhaps with a letter suggesting they start them on a cholesterol drug. Or some of the plans might actually be have programs looking at the prescribing of these potentially inappropriate drugs and sending letters to the doctors. Some of them might actually, and I can't identify any at this point, might have pharmacists available to just do general reviews. probably the most effective and the most valuable to the home care agencies would be finding pharmacies that provide them, because the pharmacies that are developing them, and I've spoken with clinical pharmacy folks at the administrative level for a couple of the chain pharmacies, they're in the process of training staff and developing processes for billing Medicare for doing appointments with patients where they're going over all their medications and reducing drug interactions and addressing kind of that comprehensive drug list. So they may not be available now, but by continuing to ask and continuing to press, you're going to start pushing them to develop them further. And once you find a few good ones, you can start making, you know, taking advantage of them. So mm-hmm. they're all over the place, but they must be out there. The plans must offer them by law. Mm-hmm. It might be hit or miss as far as what you get. The pharmacies, if they see a niche and a demand, will be prompted to offer more of these. I think at the community pharmacy level, if you can find a chain that is developing these programs and perhaps even interact with their administrations, you know, have your agency interact with that plan, say, listen, I've got 600 seniors or 3,000 seniors or 5,000 seniors who have polypharmacy. That, if you could set up a relationship where they're doing that for you, that would be a huge boon to your nurses. It may not happen overnight, but start having those dialogues now with the chains and with the plans. Because one of the caveats as far as the legislation for MTM, one of the restrictions is the patients must be higher risk. Multiple comorbidities, elderly, polypharmacy, that's almost every one of your home care patients.
Yeah, it is.
And if you're an independent corner pharmacy and you have a service like that and you know there's an agency up the street in a small town that has 30, 40 patients, that's a market for them. So really, I'd have your administrators talk to the plans and the pharmacies and perhaps your case managers for each individual case. If it's hypothetically, it's an Aetna patient who uses a Rite Aid or a Walgreens, start calling them up, or at least start putting out those feelers to see what's out there. And as time goes on, you're going to have more and more resources that you otherwise wouldn't have.
Okay, great. Okay, do we have other questions?
And again, as a reminder to our audience, that is star 1 on your touch-tone telephone if you have a question at this time.
They did not fall.
No. And we do have a question. Our first question comes from Rose Duhon of HANYS.
Oh, hello?
Hello.
Hi, I thought I cut myself off. This is Rose Duhon from Haney's, and I have a question for Darren about the MTM. I'm wondering if there are pharmacists who are interested in finding more about, that are interested in doing it and finding more about it, if they're not a chain, if they're maybe owned by a nursing home or a hospital or one of the members that's affiliated with one of the home care agencies. Is there a place to direct them that they can get the information that they would need to do the MTM?
Yeah, that's a great question. I neglected to mention that another thing going on at CMS is the adoption of those national provider ID numbers, or the NPIs.
Yep.
The national provider ID numbers are going to take over from the previous numbers that physicians and offices and things would use to bill Medicare. Pharmacists, individual pharmacists, can now register and get NPIs. So, yes, you're absolutely right. An individual pharmacist, separate from an individual pharmacy or a plan, may provide MTM services and bill Medicare as a provider. Again, it's in its infancy, but it's another thing that increases the likelihood of your being able to find a pharmacist to do this. What I would recommend you do is visit the American Society of Consultant Pharmacists webpage that's already in your packet, because
yep.
those are the pharmacists that right now are doing a lot of the consulting and drug regimen reviews at nursing homes and adult homes, and they tend to be the more entrepreneurial and the more clinically trained pharmacists who are more likely to take on a caseload if they could bill. So I think contacting the ASCP would be a great first step. You could also check out the Pharmaceutical Society webpage, PISNY, and we can get you that information if you'd like. So the Pharmaceutical Society might be another place to get resources. But I think the consultant pharmacist group is probably the one nationally that's the furthest out in front as far as pharmacists doing these things.
Great, thanks.
You're welcome.
Our next question comes from Nadine Thomas of Jewish Home and Hospital.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I truly appreciate this information of the impact that medication has on falls. I don't have a PowerPoint, but could you give me the website for the BEARS list?
Actually, it's on our website.
It's on the iPro Home Care webpage already.
Okay.
So if you can just go there and navigate, it'll be in there.
Thank you so much.
Very welcome.
Actually, that's a good point to point out here. On all of the BEERS criteria and all of the medication management tools that we shared with you back a few months ago are posted to the iPro Home Health section of the webpage under the resource section.
Yes.
And that includes the BEERS criteria, medication simplification protocol, medication compliance protocols. There's a wealth of different tools that some of the home health agencies have adopted, posted there for you to download and access.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. As a final reminder, that is star one on your touch-tone telephone if you have a question at this time. And there appears to be no further questions at this time.
Okay, great. Thank you. I thank Dr. Triller. I always learned so much from his presentations, just a wealth of knowledge, and for him sharing that with us and with all of you today. I want to remind everyone that the next clinical strategies call is going to be on March 28th. And important to note, as I sent out an email to everyone, that that call is not going to be at 9. It's going to be at 11 a.m. The time and the call-in number have changed, and we did send that information out to you. So on that date at 11, we're going to have some of our peers in the Nevada-Utah QIO Health Insights talk to you about the impact of human factors in relationship to the acute care hospitalization event tree that Chris Stiegel talked to you about a couple months back. So to accommodate them and so that they'll be awake on the call because of the time difference, we switched the call to 11 a.m. And again, if you're not able to be on that call, we'll certainly be taping it so you can access it after. But I think it'll be a really awesome call, especially with the human factors concepts. So with that, I remind you that you also have an evaluation form you received today, and we would definitely appreciate your feedback on that form. If you didn't receive it, again, it's posted with the slides on the website. So with that, I'd like to thank you for participating. I'll invite the Clinical Strategies Improvement Group to stay on the line for just a few more minutes, and we thank the rest of you for being with us. And we'll pause just for a moment so that the operator can switch over the line. Thanks.